Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Reduction in Uncompensated Care call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. Please note this call may be recorded. I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Joan Alker, Executive Director of the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families.
Thanks, Carolina. And on behalf of my colleagues here at Georgetown University CCF, I want to welcome you all to our call. The Georgetown Center for Children and Families is an independent nonpartisan policy and research center that was founded in 2005, and we are part of the Georgetown University McCourt School of Public Policy. So today's call is going to focus on a new report that we're releasing today. By my colleagues, our co-authors, Jack Hodely, who is a research professor here at the McCourt School, and Adam Searing, who is a senior research fellow at the McCourt School and the Center for Children and Families. And it looks at some of the emerging differences between states that have expanded Medicaid and states that have not expanded Medicaid. And just by way of introduction, I want to mention that as many of you and probably all of you know, the Supreme Court in its ruling on the Affordable Care Act decided that this part of the Affordable Care Act would be an option essentially for states. So we now have 30 states plus the District of Columbia that have moved ahead, and the remaining states have not. So in essence, as some researchers at a meeting I was at shortly after the Supreme Court decision said, this created a natural experiment, for better or for worse, probably for worse for those in the non-expansion states, but it did create a situation now where we can look at the impact in states that have chosen to accept the federal funding versus states that have not. And lots of studies have started to do that. The kinds of studies that we have seen emerging so far, and they've been fairly consistent in their findings, have been in roughly three different areas. One set of data has been looking at the reductions in the uninsured rate, which has been quite dramatic and greater in states that have expanded Medicaid. Some of these studies are also starting to look at access to care that results from having the Medicaid coverage. A second group of studies has been looking at the impact on state budgets, which generally has been favorable as well. And then also we have seen research and findings and reports, particularly from hospital systems, looking at the reductions in uncompensated care that have come along with the expansion. So what this particular report attempts to do, and our new research today, looks at a related area to the last point that I made. We interviewed, Jack and Adam, interviewed providers in states that have expanded versus states that haven't, and really asked them how the expansion was impacting the healthcare delivery system. What are the opportunities for improvements in the delivery system or not, depending on whether your state has expanded? So it's a little bit of a new twist on these looks at expansion versus non-expansion states. So I think you'll find these results very interesting. So I'll just quickly run through for you what the plan is today for the call. We are going to hear first from Professor Jack Hodely, one of the authors of the study. And then we are going to be hearing from Paul Taylor, who is the CEO of the Ozarks Community Hospital. He was interviewed, as part of the study, and his safety net hospital system operates facilities in both Missouri, which has not expanded Medicaid, and Arkansas, which has expanded Medicaid. So he is living the natural experiment, and he's going to talk to us about that. And then finally, we will hear from Adam Searing from Georgetown CCF, who will conclude the presentation, and we will move to questions. So this call is on the record. It is also being recorded. After we hear from the speakers, we're going to open it up for questions. And we will, as a courtesy to members of the media who might be on deadline, we will allow them to ask the first questions and then open it up to the wider audience. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jack Hodely.
Thank you, Joan. As Joan said, we wanted to go deeper beyond some of the studies that have looked at differences in uninsured rates or uncompensated care to look at the impact that Medicaid expansion has had on the delivery system in the states that have expanded Medicaid as compared to states that have not. And so we interviewed officials that worked at safety net providers, both safety net hospitals and federally qualified health centers in a variety of expansion states that included Arkansas, Colorado, Kentucky, and Nevada, as well as non-expansion states in Missouri, Tennessee, and Utah. And the differences we heard from our respondents in these states were truly dramatic. First, our interviews reinforced the story that we've seen in the statistics on coverage. So one CEO told us that the share of uninsured patients at his clinics had dropped from 51% to 17% in the expansion state in which he operates. Financially, for that clinic system, it meant a one-year reversal from a $2.5 million loss to a $2.5 million gain just in the 1 year. Similarly, a hospital CEO told us that his operating margin had moved from just 0.1% to 4%. But these numbers are merely the starting point for the story. These financial improvements and improvements in the number of people with insurance are really creating a broader and positive ripple effect on the healthcare system in expansion states. As one health center executive told us, we were at risk of laying off staff and closing health centers. The Affordable Care Act put us back in a growth position and allowed us to add staff to keep up with the volume of patient visits. By contrast, a center director in a non-expansion state said that the foregone income by not having coverage for her clients meant she found it's harder to balance the mission. There's an unmet need in that area, and it is growing. So these are really dramatic differences in how executives with these safety net institutions are seeing the healthcare system. But furthermore, the added resources create real opportunities for them to make positive changes to the delivery system. So it isn't just that they can see more patients with insurance and have a better financial bottom line. One clinic director told us about dramatically increased communication with the other healthcare providers in the community. This translates then into improved care coordination across the community and better continuity of care for their patients as they move through the health system. It takes resources to create these kinds of linkages with the other providers and make them operate. In addition, health system leaders in several of the expansion states highlighted increased integration of care for their patients, particularly between behavioral health care and primary care, a key need for many of the people that enroll in Medicaid. Some of the examples we heard about included facilities that were adding psychologists or now nurses to their staffs to deal with behavioral health issues, the ability to identify and address behavioral health issues on the spot during a healthcare visit, do something right away, providing a behavioral health visit and a primary care medical visit on the same day instead of having to schedule those on different days, and thus better serve patients that have both types of healthcare needs. In addition, we heard from some providers about expanded dental services, a greater focus on delivering healthcare services to those who are homeless, and more coordination services for those with multiple chronic conditions. And so really, it's a story of providing better care, more integrated care. And these examples all came in Medicaid expansion states where the added resources have allowed providers to improve their delivery systems and do good things both for the patients who come to their facilities and for their communities more broadly. It's also true that the changes that they're seeing are having a positive impact, economic impact on their communities because they're able to hire more staff to staff their facilities, to expand or open new facilities, and to keep community residents healthier, which in turn has a positive economic impact if they can stay working at their jobs. It's not a completely 100% positive story. There are still challenges in getting specialty care, whether you're in an expansion state or a non-expansion state, getting specialty care for low-income Medicaid patients. But even there, we saw a difference. There are more steps being taken in the expansion states to address the issue of providing specialty care. One executive told us that Medicaid expansion has opened the door to specialists being willing to serve our Medicaid patients, and they're able to capitalize on programs because they can afford to create this outreach, and they can also know that many of their patients now have an insurance card to take with them when they go to get specialty care that can't be provided directly in the safety net clinic or the safety net hospital. What happens when somebody leaves that hospital and goes on to need follow-up care? So I think these are really significant changes, dramatic changes that we saw. You know, as a researcher, you know, we go in and often the results we see in a study are somewhat ambiguous. You see some factors pointing you in one direction, some factors pointing you in another direction. But this is a case where we really saw consistently and dramatic differences between what we were being told by the executives who worked in facilities in Medicaid expansion states versus those who came from non-expansion states. And so to amplify on that theme, I'm going to now turn over the microphone to one of the providers we talked to. As Joan mentioned, Paul Taylor is CEO at the Ozarks Community Hospital with facilities in both Missouri and Arkansas, and he will now offer his perspective on care delivery in those different environments. Paul?
Yeah, thank you. I heard Joan referred to Ozarks Community Hospital as a living experiment, and I guess we have the scars to prove it. To give everyone a perspective on Ozarks Community Hospital, we are a safety net provider system. We have a hospital in Arkansas and a hospital in Missouri. The two hospitals are about 100 miles apart as the crow flies. We're in the Ozarks, and both hospitals are in the Ozark regions. We have primary care clinics scattered throughout the Ozark region. Our focus is mainly on primary care, but we're a living experiment, not simply because we have a hospital in an expansion state, Arkansas, and a non-expansion state, Missouri. We're also a living experiment because our patient payer mix is 90% governmental and uninsured, and so with that, the impact of the result of the Supreme Court decision, so that in some states the Medicaid expanded and some states didn't, means that, you know, the bargain of the Affordable Care Act was supposed to be that you're going to ultimately get paid less by the governmental payers, by Medicare and to some extent by Medicaid, in exchange for which a larger percentage of your uninsured patients were then going to be covered under Medicaid. Hospitals that have a large commercial insurance patient payer mix were able to soften the blow in non-expansion states. Those like OCH that did not were hit the hardest. And so in Missouri, where there was no expansion of Medicaid, our uninsured payer mix in our ER and has been 33% historically. It remained that way during the first years of non-expansion in Missouri, but it's actually been ticking up, and we're about occasionally 40 to 45% uninsured in the emergency room. Whereas in Arkansas, we had a similar uninsured payer mix. About a third of the patients prior to expansion were uninsured. Now that payer mix has dropped to 10% or below, and in fact that's our patient payer mix throughout the Arkansas hospital system now is less than 10% of the patients we treat are uninsured. That led to a number of consequences for Ozarks Community Hospital. About 2 years ago, during a six-month period of time, so it would have been in 2014, we decreased our FTEs in Missouri by 100 and at the same time increased our employment in Arkansas by about the same 100 people, 100 FTEs. We hung on, frankly, as long as we could in Missouri, waiting for the legislature to change its mind about expansion, but we finally just simply had to give up. If we hadn't reduced our payroll in Missouri, we were jeopardizing the entire system. So we shrank operations. We reduced the services we were providing at the hospital, and we laid off a bunch of folks. And we had to basically reinvent ourselves. And the fact remains that right now, if it weren't for the positive operating margin we're experiencing in Arkansas, the entire system would be out of business. The positive operating margin we're experiencing in Arkansas, we're using to subsidize the Missouri operation so that we can continue in business. And for us, part of that means, we have what we feel like is a fairly innovative approach to integrated care. We do some of the things mentioned about what that means, the model, which is to provide both a behavioral visit and a medical visit, you know, the same day. We have psychologists, you know, who are stationed in our medical clinics so that they can see patients when they're coming in to see the doctor and the other providers. We made a commitment to do that system-wide, and so we're doing it even in Missouri, even though a number of the patients that are getting that model of care, you know, are uninsured, and so we're simply covering the costs. And the frankly, the way we're covering the costs is because we have a positive operating margin in Arkansas. So the expansion state is benefiting Missouri to a certain extent, simply because, you know, we're able to continue the mission because we're making a little bit of money down there. The other thing we're seeing happen, and this is not just anecdotal, it happened with us, we're seeing a brain drain where providers, when they have a choice about which state to go to, are choosing the state that has expanded Medicaid, the state that seems to have a brighter economic future. One of my best primary care doctors, a physician with a huge practice, recently relocated from Missouri to Arkansas, and he's enjoying a thriving practice down there and hopes to do so, you know, until he retires. I have a number of specialists who are based in Springfield, Missouri, where our hospital is, who are now traveling to Arkansas and providing specialty care to the patient population down there, because we've had a shrinking volume of service and a shrinking menu of service in Missouri. So that, you know, it to us, it's been very real. It's been an almost horrific experiment to have to live through, but so far, at least, we're hanging on.
Great. Thank you, Paul. That was incredibly interesting, and I'm now going to turn it over to Adam to wrap up. Adam Searing. Adam, we can't hear you if you're speaking. You may be muted.
Sorry. Yeah, I am. Thanks, Joan, and thanks, Paul, and Jack, too, and Paul especially. I think we asked you to come and speak, and your experiences with facilities in both states, really, we were struck by how much that your experiences are mirrored by our other respondents in other states, expansion and non-expansion. So I think you both have said a lot, covered a lot of what we've covered in the paper. I really, you know, wanted to just echo first Jack's point that, you know, he and I, when we went into doing this paper, we knew that we would be, you know, talking to people who were talking about reductions in uninsured rate and reductions in uncompensated care, and maybe, you know, being able to hire more specialists other providers. But we really didn't realize, and it was very, very startling to us, how the huge differences that were emerging that do seem to be emerging between Medicaid expansion and non-expansion states. I think you've heard a lot of reasons or a lot of the what's been going on in two different states, and Paul has certainly given, you know, the firsthand account of what's happening in his facilities. But really, it seems like, you know, that the financial security that Medicaid expansion brings, coupled with the fact that now most in an expansion state, most of the patient safety net providers are seen, are covered, really is allowing these safety net providers to do just what we would like safety net providers to do and invest into their communities. They don't have to scrape by, so they're able to, like Paul was saying, hire new providers or work on efforts to better integrate care. I think the other thing that's happening is since they don't have to worry about who is taking care of the most uninsured, because, you know, now with Medicaid expansion, most of the uninsured are covered, they can have the freedom to sit down and talk about how are we going to work together to make sure that the care we're giving to this pool of folks is the absolute best and most integrated care we can. And what seems to be happening is that the health system is transforming. And really there, you know, you take a step back. To me, there seem to be two Americas forming in healthcare driven by these state Medicaid expansion decisions. There's one where healthcare systems are improving, care is more integrated and easier to access, and another in non-expansion states where the status quo is being maintained and problems are continuing. So from our research, while getting people covered is the first effect that a Medicaid expansion brings to a state, it's really the first step to creating a better and more coordinated healthcare system. And I think in the end, states that haven't yet expanded, this is the tip of the iceberg. We're going to be doing more research on this, but states that haven't yet expanded really do have another reason to look at the state expansion decision again. And that reason is the desire to improve their health system, not just get people covered, but to improve their health system. So in the end, I was thinking about how to wrap up everything we had talked about here. And I was really struck yesterday. I was reading an op-ed by the State Department of Health Secretary in North Carolina. And he was talking about a waiver that they had submitted to the federal government recently that aims to do some of these very good things, integrate health care for patients, have more coordination from providers. It's also talking about moving more people into a different managed care system. But I was very struck by many of the things that North Carolina was talking about doing, which are admirable things, integrating care better, moving behavioral health and medical visits together, the sorts of things that they want to do, that those are already happening in expansion states because the providers just serve organically. The providers have the freedom and the ability to do that. So I think this is very, very interesting research, and I really want to thank Paul and Jack for being willing to participate and working so hard on the front line, and then Jack and I being able to talk to so many gracious heads of these institutions who are willing to share their experiences with us. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Adam, and thanks to all the speakers. That was a terrific presentation. And Carolina, could you instruct our listeners how to ask questions?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and 1 on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue at any time by pressing the pound key. We'll pause momentarily to allow questions to queue.
Okay, so as questions are queuing, I think we have one already, Carolina, so do you want to?
And we'll take our first question from Brian Thompson. Your line's open.
Hi, thank you very much. I was wondering, I'm in Kansas, and we keep hearing reasons or excuses about how we don't want to serve people who should be, getting a job. They're able-bodied. They don't need Medicaid. We can't afford it. The state's costs are going to be too high. How do you get people in positions of power to care about this issue?
Okay. I'd like to take that one. I think it would be great to hear from Paul on this question in a minute, and I know Jack and Adam have thoughts as well. So, Adam, do you want to just start, and Paul, we'd love for you to jump in as well.
Sure. I mean, I'm interested to hear what Paul has to say, too. We can set the data out there, and I think my hope is that eventually that the differences between states will become so dramatic that, reluctant policymakers in states that haven't yet decided to take the federal Medicaid money will, look at the wealth of evidence out there and think, well, there may be certain things I disagree with, but maybe we can make some compromises and move forward because there are just so many benefits in states that are moving that way. We're not lobbyists or politicians, so we can't try and click our fingers, but I think we can just make the clearest case. And I would be willing to say to anyone that I think it is rare to see such big differences when you're talking between states, and I think we're just going to continue to see those differences. So if you're interested not in just covering more people, but in also kind of trying to build a better health system, it seems like taking this Medicaid money is one way to do that.
Well, this is Paul. The question was, how do you make people care? And that's a real good question. I hit them with a club. But you have to kind of attack it one piece at a time. So you said you don't want to provide health care for welfare bums, people that don't work. Well, show them the numbers. Most of the people in the states that didn't expand, I don't care which state it is, I know what the numbers are in Missouri, it's going to be the same in Kansas. You're talking about providing health coverage for the working poor, not for people who don't work at all. Because for the fact of the matter is, if they're unemployed and complete, they're probably being covered under your state Medicaid program. If they're disabled, or it's a mother with children that is not working, and the people that are unable to afford health insurance are the folks that are working for $8, $9, $10 an hour that are trying to raise a family on that kind of money, and their employer doesn't provide health care. So it's the working poor that we're asking people to care about and to reach out and say, you're doing the best you can, and the best you can is to find a job that pays $9 an hour and it doesn't come with health insurance. So let's cover them so they can continue to work and not have a disincentive to work, frankly. So that's one reason to care. It's, caring about people that are already doing the best they can. But the other thing, if you don't care about people, you can say to the business interests, you ought to do this. You ought to expand Medicaid because it's a really good business investment. If you compare the dollars being spent in states that expanded Medicare and the economic benefit of that to how many states wouldn't, give their left arm away to, some company that was promising to bring a factory in that was going to employ a number of people. Well, look at the economic impact in states that have expanded Medicaid compared to the cost of bringing in, a few mythical employers that would suddenly begin employing people paying $20 to, $30 an hour. So it's an economic stimulus package. And so if you can't get them to care about people, get them to care about economics. I have looked at the data about states that have expanded Medicaid and states that have not. And, you can try to explain it away all you want to, but the fact is states that have expanded Medicaid are doing better economically than the states that did not. So that's where I'd hit them. I'd hit them on the economic stimulus part of it. The fact is the states that did not expand Medicaid are losing an economic battle, and they're losing ground that they may never recover. I certainly see that happening in Missouri as compared to Arkansas. There's a building boom going on in Arkansas right now in the healthcare sector, and there's a bunch of folks like me in Missouri that are just barely hanging on.
Thank you. Jeff, do you want to add anything?
I was simply going to add that part of what we saw in the conversations we had with healthcare leaders is that not only is there the kind of economic impact that Paul just talked about, but there's an impact in care delivery that Adam was alluding to, that an institution, the safety net institutions, are going to serve people whether they come in with insurance or not if they need the health care. That's the mission for a safety net hospital like Paul's or a healthcare clinic. But they're threatened. The saying is no margin, no mission, and they're threatened to be able to carry out their mission if they don't have the dollars coming in. And furthermore, what we heard was that when they get these additional dollars, they do things to improve the care they deliver to the broader community. And so it has a positive effect, not just in the jobs created that Paul talked about, but also in the quality of health care that the community gets.
Great. Thank you, Jack. Carolina, can we get the instructions one more time for asking questions?
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one.
Okay. So while we're seeing if we have other questions, I'm going to throw out a question. You mentioned, I think, Jack and Adam a little bit as well, but a pretty hot topic today is behavioral health. And so relate to all three of you. Can you talk a little bit more about what you heard with respect to the integration of behavioral health and physical health?
Yeah, this is Jack. I mean, one of the things that really is the case in when systems improve the way they talk about integration of behavioral health and medical health care is both to provide the ability for their regular primary care providers to recognize behavioral health problems and do something about it to identify the patients that need it. And to do that, they may need additional training. They may need additional preparation, and that takes resources to create that. And then this ability, and I think Paul gave an example of this, to be able to provide services on the same day and the same appointment. So again, if you don't have adequate staff to provide behavioral health services, if you don't have the psychologists, the social workers, the nurses that can provide these kinds of services, they're on staff on a regular basis, you may not be able to set up those appointments. And then if you tell somebody they've got to come back for an appointment on a later day to deal with their additional health care, maybe they came in because their diabetes was out of control, but in talking to that patient, you discover that they also are depressed. And if you've got a somebody you can hand them off to, what they call a warm handoff in the industry, then you can get that person directly to see that psychologist maybe the same day while they're already there and do something and talk to them about the depression that they've been dealing with, which then has a ripple effect back on potentially improving their ability to adhere to their treatment for diabetes that was the problem that brought them in the first place. To do these kinds of things takes resources, and that's where the dollars that come in through Medicaid expansion, through people having this coverage, allows these institutions to provide those kinds of services.
Great. Paul or Adam, would you like to add anything on the behavioral health question?
Well, this is Paul. I would add this. This really cuts across payer issues, and there are at-risk patients, and kind of in the old days when people said at-risk patients, they typically meant they were at risk because they were uninsured and, you know, so they couldn't access health care. But, well, we've redefined that now, and we'd like to redefine it in the state of Missouri. We're simply not getting paid well enough. But we've redefined at-risk patients to mean those patients that have chronic diseases, probably chronic behavioral issues, chronic pain management issues. In other words, they are the patients that when they come into a primary care doctor, they have a medical chart that scares off the primary care doctor. Frankly, a primary care doctor doesn't want to accept a patient like that, regardless of payer source. And the only way to really try to help that patient population that's at risk because they're very difficult patients to care for. They tend to be non-compliant. They're dealing with depression and chronic pain and you know, COPD and diabetes and you know, probably overweight to boot. So you got a complex set of conditions that you're dealing with, and for a single doctor to take that on without the support of an entire team of providers, well, they just can't do it. They just say, no, I'm sorry, I can't help you, and that at-risk patient goes on down the road regardless of payer source. But here's where Medicaid expansion impacts that. The only way that you can effectively care for at-risk patients is to develop an integrated care model, a medical home model that brings a whole team together to take care of those patients. The only way you can do it, and you can't do it for patient A that has commercial insurance that comes into your clinic and not do it for patient B that's uninsured. You can't do that. Once you've adopted a model to deliver care a certain way, you have to do it for every patient that comes into your practice, that comes into the clinic. And so that means that, you know, if you have a high percentage of uninsured patients coming into that practice, you're now delivering a more expensive kind of care under this team model. It's a lot more expensive to do. It's the right thing to do, but if you're doing it for a third of the patients and you're not getting paid for them at all, you're not going to make it. And so that's why the Medicaid expansion is so vitally necessary. You can upgrade your model and you can provide integrated care under a true team approach in a medical home, and you can do it if you know that most of your patients are going to have a payer source. It's very difficult to do it if a bunch of your folks are not covered.
Thanks, Paul. I think we have another question, but Adam, do you want to jump in quickly?
Oh, I'll just end with one sentence. I mean, I think Paul and Jack have said most of it, but you know, we do know that about 20% of Medicaid beneficiaries do have some sort of nationally have some sort of behavioral health diagnosis, but they account for about half of all the Medicaid expenditures. So if you're going to improve the healthcare delivery system for people on Medicaid, you're going to have to integrate behavioral and medical visits some way. And so I just want to echo what Paul and Jack said about the expansion making that much easier to do, but it's also necessary given the magnitude of the need.
Great. Okay. Carolina, we can go to our next question.
And we'll take our next question from Jim Carnes. Your line is open.
Thank you. I'm calling from Alabama, and here we're sort of, the Kansas question sounded very familiar. We're trying to throw as much against the wall as we can to see if anything will stick. But one thing we're particularly interested in right now is the mental and behavioral health issue that you've been talking about with the last question, particularly in the setting of the corrections system. And so I wondered, I mean, and first of all, thank you for this really compelling conversation, but I wondered if any of you have been looking at the impact of expansion on the delivery of mental health care as it intersects with the criminal justice system.
So I'm going to let others jump in a second. That has not been something we've done a lot of work on. I think there is a growing interest in that area, and we can circle back with you offline, Jim, if we can find some good leads for you. But, Jack, do you want to comment on if that issue arose as you wrote this report?
We did not hear anybody bring up that particular issue. I mean, some of the issues come to the fact that we're really talking to the community providers, the clinics and the safety net hospitals who, you know, may be the ultimate source of care for somebody who's in a correctional facility who eventually gets taken to the hospital when a system is complicated. But sort of the first level of care provision is often through the correction system itself. And that may be through sort of other sources of care. So this is one of these cases where the nature of how care is going to be provided to these individuals has got to be coordinated against across different sectors of the healthcare system. So it really just adds an extra complication. Many of these people, when they leave the corrections facility, will end up on Medicaid, and certainly that's a piece of it.
Paul or Adam, any additional thoughts?
Well, this is Paul. It actually piggybacks on what I was talking about with those at-risk patients. Unsurprisingly, a lot of those at-risk patients are also patients that are in and out of criminal trouble. And it's just a fact that if you were in a community where virtually everybody had health benefits, then when you work with law enforcement, and law enforcement knows when they've got a person that whose criminal behavior is really a medical problem, a behavioral problem. The problem is in many communities, they know that they are the de facto mental health care provider because that patient doesn't have any benefits, and it's going to be pretty hard to get a health care provider to do much for them. And so, you know, that's how the system has evolved the way it has happened, because, you know, there's no trust that when you have a situation that obviously involves some aspect of mental health, that the folks in the criminal justice system can go, look, we just need to get this guy or gal with, you know, with a psychiatrist or psychologist or a team of healthcare providers. In those communities where it becomes a community effort and there's some trust and confidence that you can do so without placing your organization at risk, that you can provide help, you know what, help gets provided. You can watch it happen. And it happens in those communities where you develop a good working relationship between law enforcement and the healthcare providers. But the grease that makes that happen is you got to have a payer source.
Thank you. I guess I would just flag the disparities between expansion and non-expansion states in terms of their criminal justice populations and such, and health outcomes of incarcerated population might be something you want to track as well going forward.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. That's a great point. I think we have another question, Carolina.
Yes, we'll take our next question from Michelle Delfavero. Your line's open.
Hi, this is Michelle with ACSCAN, and I just have a question. As far as when you were interviewing the health executives, did you hear any differences between a standard expansion versus a state who's expanded with a waiver?
I would say we did not generally focus on that element. Obviously, we did have, you know, Arkansas as one of our locations where, you know, there was a waiver involved, but I think we did not try to draw out those particular things. What we saw were strong differences in all of the state situations that we saw, regardless of whether they were done through waivers or not. So I guess in a sense the answer is no, we didn't see differences, but to be fair, we did not particularly ask about those differences.
Yeah, and this is Adam. I don't have anything. I think Jack said it succinctly. We didn't ask about it, but we also didn't hear about it. And we did, and remember, too, I think the interesting thing about our work was, you know, these executives, Paul included, were willing to have, you know, half hour, 45 minute, in some cases even an hour discussion with us. So we did really try and give them lots and lots of time to talk about all the different aspects of the, you know, of what they were seeing, at least from their vantage point.
So, Michelle, this is Joan. You're a woman after my own heart asking that question. I was just going to jump in and mention there was some other research that was done and I think continuing to be done by Dr. Ben Summers at Harvard, and he was looking at Arkansas, Kentucky, and Texas, if I remember correctly. And so he did look at this question with respect to access to care. Now, I was looking at Arkansas, which arguably is probably not that different on the ground for people as, say, perhaps a state like Indiana, where you have a lot more wrinkles. But generally, he found that there were not any differences in Arkansas and Kentucky. It was the big difference was between those states and Texas, which hadn't expanded. So again, kind of reinforcing that that the waiver versus non-waiver in his research did not prove to be all that consequential. It was really the question of how you expand it or not. But having said that, I think Arkansas, you know, is a little bit different. They don't have premiums or copays or some of the kind of weird benefit wrinkles that a state like Indiana has.
And I know we're seeing
right.
that a lot more in a lot of the states. So that's why I was just curious if you had happened to see any differences just, you know, even casually, since obviously that's not exactly what this study was about.
Go ahead, Adam.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, I think we, you know, at the end of our paper, we listed a number of areas where we thought we could, you know, were very fruitful for more research, and I think that would certainly be one of them, because it would be fascinating to see the some states that are not, that have expanded with a waiver, if there are these differences. But.
And I was just going to say, I don't know that any of the states that we looked at, you know, had the sort of Indiana-style waivers that John was talking about. So, you know, it would take additional research, I think, to tease that out more fully on a study like this.
Great. Thank you, Michelle. Let's do a final call for questions. Carolina, if you just want to remind folks.
And once again, to ask a question, please press star and one.
Okay. So we will see if there are any final questions. And if not, I'm going to just ask our speakers, and we will start, we'll go in reverse order, so we'll start with Adam, then move to Paul and Jack, just for any concluding thoughts that you might have. Adam?
I guess my only thought is that, you know, I just want to emphasize, I think in, you know, there's a lot of work out there about the reductions in uncompensated care, the reductions in the uninsured rate, but what, you know, Jack and I are seeing, and Paul is seeing, you know, as he's delivering care through our interviews across states, is that the health care system itself in these Medicaid expansion states is actually starting to change for the better. And that is a very, very significant milestone. I think that's and it should hopefully play a role when states are making a decision about whether or not to expand Medicaid, because you know this is a big change we're talking about beyond just simply reducing the number of uninsured people in a state, which is important enough in itself.
Great, thanks, Adam. Paul?
Well, I can just add this. I've been in a room in Arkansas with close to 30-some-odd hospital administrators from small rural hospitals, and I've been in a room in Missouri with 30-some-odd hospital administrators, and the mood, if you could just somehow quantify that and present it, it's gloom and doom with my fellow small and rural hospital administrators in Missouri. They're all just hanging on. I mean, there's a large majority of them that simply don't know if they're going to still be open in a year from now. That's the way it is. That's reality now. And none of them are optimistic that there's going to be Medicaid expansion in the state of Missouri. There's been no indication that we have any movement going on in the legislature. And so, it's one thing to hang on if you think there's relief on the way, but when you're hanging on knowing that with almost certainty that there is no relief, it's tough. It's tough to keep hanging on. And, you know, frankly, it's the opposite mood in Arkansas. People are talking about, I didn't talk about it, but we replaced 100% of our radiology equipment in our hospital in Gravette, Arkansas, about $3 million worth of radiology equipment. I never would have, and I'm the guy that has to personally guarantee those kinds of things, and there's no way I guarantee an expenditure like that for my hospital down there unless I'm real confident that the future looks bright. And so, yeah, there's an imaginary dividing line in the border between Missouri and Arkansas, but there's a real qualitative difference in what's going on in healthcare right now.
Thanks, Paul. Jack?
Yeah, I just reinforced a couple of the points I already made. I mean, this really does go beyond just uninsured numbers and uncompensated care numbers. Those are all great indicators, and it's a sign of health for the people involved, a sign of health for the institutions involved. But we really did see, as has been said several times, changes in the nature of how care is delivered. Just the kind of comment Paul just made, the ability to improve the sort of equipment that's available is going to mean better care for those folks who come to that Arkansas hospital. The ability to create alliances among the different institutions in a community to say that they really will work together better because they've got the resources to perhaps provide a social worker who becomes the person who makes contacts between institutions to see that care is integrated when people move around the system. And then last, just to reinforce that as a researcher who's done a lot of studies over the years, many of which you really work to try to say, okay, is the difference I saw strong enough to really be real? Is it statistically valid? Is it a real difference? This is one where that was an easy answer. You know, we saw such dramatic differences in the interviews. It's just, again, like Paul said, it's that line on the map becomes a real line in the nature of what's going on in the healthcare system, whether it's the Arkansas-Missouri border, whether it's the Kentucky-Tennessee border, whether it's the Colorado-Nevada border, the different places we saw. There's just a dramatic difference in what's going on in the healthcare systems across these different state lines.
And I think to conclude, especially in light of Paul's comment that there doesn't seem to be any movement in Missouri for those of you in states who haven't expanded, the reality is that opposition to this expansion is very ideologically based, and the arguments that we hear about state budgets collapsing and all of these bad things happening as time marches on and we have states that have expanded and we see what's happening in those states and we learn about that and we research, those claims will either be true or false. And that's what's so important about doing this kind of work. And I really want to thank all of our speakers today for a wonderful discussion. And thanks, everybody, for a great call.
Okay. Thank you, Jen.
Here.